Pakistan has called out army to help police and other paramilitary personnel to enforce strict precautionary measures in bazaars and streets to contain what the government says a sudden surge in COVID-19 cases.
Agar humne ab ehtiyat na ki.
Prime Minister Imran Khan in a televised address warned the nation that his country may soon be facing a grim situation similar to that of India, where on an average 2,000 people die every day and more than 300,000 test positive.
I have appealed to the people time and again to follow precautionary measures. However, neither people are scared of coronavirus nor they are adopting any precautionary measures. And that is where now there is surge in coronavirus cases.
Under a new decision, Pakistan has shut down schools in regions with a surge in COVID-19 cases. All markets would be closed by 6 p.m. Indoor and outdoor dining have also been banned. Only 50% staff would be allowed to work in private and government offices, while offices would be closed at 2 p.m. On an average, 100 to 150 people die daily, while between 5,000 to 6,000 people test positive every day in 220 million populated country. So far, there are as many as 102,000 total active cases in Pakistan, while nearly 16,900 people have died since March last year. The government has warned the people to get ready to face complete lockdown of major urban centers if they do not put a mask on their faces to contain the virus.
People would die with hunger if government shuts down the cities. There would be shortage of food items like sugar, flour and oil. What would we do then?
A survey conducted by Gallup Pakistan last month reported that 65% people believe that the government is exaggerating the threat of the COVID-19.
A significant number of people suffer from allergic-linked diseases such as flu, cough, fever and asthma, and many of them die every spring weather in parts of Pakistan. However, since March last year, the medical nomenclature in Pakistan have changed, and now most of these diseases have been officially classified as COVID-19 cases under what is medically known as PCR testing system, which many medical experts believe are churning out false positive cases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Despite the lockdown and curfew, thousands took the streets in Paris to protest against the reform of the social security system. The main reform concerns unemployed people who will receive less unemployment benefits. They will suffer an average loss of 20%, and some will even lose 45% of their unemployment compensation, meaning 300 euros less by month. Many will not be able to pay their rent. The demonstrators blame the French government for taking advantage of the COVID crisis to accelerate anti-popular measures.
Those who will be sanctioned by this reform are those who already suffer the most from the decrease in the work volume due to the COVID crisis. All the vulnerable workers who already lost their job and who are not financially supported by the government will become unemployed and will be affected by this reform. Yes, the government takes advantage of the crisis and pushes for unjust reforms.
Cultural workers made the demonstration very lively. They are paying a heavy price due to the outbreak of the COVID-19.
Today, people who work in the cultural sector often return to their parents and have no income anymore. Since more than 1 year, we don't work, we don't earn money, and the government does not propose any solution to us. Culture is part of the freedom of expression. Only the big shows financed by the state will survive, and the others will disappear.
Billions are given to big companies, 500 billion euros. At the same time, these companies fire workers. How is it possible that this government is making the shareholders richer instead of helping the population?
Indeed, the French stock exchange market has reached a very high level with more than 6,000 points. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well since the COVID crisis, but the majority of the population does not benefit from this. More than 100 symbolic cultural places like the Odeon Theater are occupied since weeks, with protesters vowing to continue demonstrations until their demands are met. The COVID crisis will inevitably lead to loss of jobs for many workers. Also, if unemployment benefits are affected, these workers will be punished twice. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Much of America breathed a sigh of relief when the cop who killed George Floyd was convicted of murder. A not guilty verdict was widely expected to have set off deadly rebellions on the scale of 1968 when Martin Luther King was assassinated, or 1992 when cops were acquitted in the Rodney King beating case. But across the country, there's a feeling that the calm won't last, because cops in America kill an average of 3 people per day. With police now often forced to wear body cameras and cell phones serving as citizen cameras, there seems to be a constant stream of shocking cop killings on the nightly news. North Carolina, Oklahoma, here in Chicago, and in too many other places to count, have all seen major protests against police violence in the past weeks. Storefronts are being boarded up, and many wonder if they will stay that way all summer.
I mean, if someone knocked out on election night and they woke up today and you told them everything that was happening, if they didn't really pay that much attention to politics, aside from like the media telling them that Trump is bad, they would say, oh, Trump's still in power. I feel like the cops throughout the country, even in Chicago, have become even more emboldened than last year.
The George Floyd protests in 2020 were highly politicized by the Democratic Party. But many wonder if the party will encourage the same confrontational stances in 2021. President Joe Biden reportedly discussed deploying the National Guard to all 50 states ahead of the Floyd verdict, while some Republican-led states are introducing often shocking anti-protest legislation.
The protest that we saw in 2020 was more of a prelude than anything, because now that all these facts are out there, now that, like, you know, there's a huge light shining on police violence and how this is connected to the state and how the state continually arms the police no matter what they do. Even if they've just murdered a 13-year-old kid, what is the state going to propose? More money to go to cops to train them, and that training goes to nothing.
The United States has become so divided that the threat of socioeconomic violence now occurs on a regular basis. Underpinning it all appears to be the widespread perception of a lack of justice caused by a fundamental corruption which appears almost impossible to remedy. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Israeli regime seems to be living in an unprecedented state of restlessness after a rocket reached what the Dimona mayor calls the most secure area in the world. Many observers consider the event as a clear intelligence and defense failure, whether the rocket was purposely aimed at the Dimona nuclear site or not.
There is much confusion among the Israelis. This unprecedented breach led the Israelis to question the capability and readiness of the Israeli home front and the capability of the military and political leadership. They are linking this event with other events in the region, mainly concerning Iran and Syria.
The military official statement changed its story on the explosion in an apparent confusion, first saying a Patriot rocket hit the Syrian rocket, while a later statement admitted that Israeli defenses failed to intercept it. Israel claims that SA-4, a long-range projectile handled by Syria's Russian-made S-200 missile system, had been fired at an Israeli aircraft to defend Syria from an Israeli attack, but had, quote, overflown its target and landed near the Dimona nuclear reactor. Israeli media have questioned the official clarification.
There are several questions that the Israeli army needs to ask itself. In the heart of this, there are continuous operations of the Israeli Air Force against Iranian targets in Syria. We have to say honestly, we began this. It began with the attack of the Air Force on Syria, and the Syrians always launch air defense rockets. The Israeli army's analysis is that if they wanted to target the Dimona reactor to retaliate for Natanz operation, they would have fired a more precise missile.
The missile incident came days after Iran warned that it will retaliate for a recent Israeli cyber attack against its Natanz nuclear facility. While the Israeli regime continuously targets Iran's nuclear facilities, it exclusively maintains a military nuclear program and arsenal with hundreds of nuclear warheads, which threaten the entire MENA region.
There is clear that the West is overlooking the Israeli nuclear program despite the fact that everyone knows that this secretive facility holds a military nuclear reactor for around 60 years now. They have an arsenal of tens of nuclear warheads. This nuclear threat is part of the Western hegemony over the region, and it was originally built by the West.
Analysts believe this event foreshadows a certain incapability of the Israeli military to protect its home front in the case of a war with the resistance, which could fire tens of rockets daily. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and the number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abd Latif Al-Washali from Hodeidah.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states and maybe in terms of age or gender. Are some states not using AstraZeneca at all? And I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying, we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 70, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
crisis is deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The funeral of a 59-year-old woman, and only her close relatives are performing the last rites. Her family says she didn't die of the coronavirus, but due to lack of space in the hospital, the second wave of COVID-19 pandemic has brought the country's healthcare on the brink of collapse as hospitals struggle with lack of resources and space. The country is battling with lack of oxygen supplies and spaces to cremate the dead ones.
We are running out of space here. We have cremated around 40 bodies since morning. This is crisis. We are tired and overwhelmed.
Just a mile away from the crematorium, a truck loaded with oxygen cylinders is preparing a delivery to some nearby hospitals, with police protection, as oxygen tankers and cylinders are being looted in some parts of the country. This truck loader says, "We are working 24/7 to deliver as much as we can. So are the ambulance drivers."
This is war, not a pandemic. We are restless. We are running out of ambulances and oxygen supplies, but we are trying our best to save lives.
On Friday, India reported over 330,000 fresh cases of coronavirus, which is the highest daily increase the country has recorded so far. Over 2,200 deaths were also reported across the country, with the state of Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh, New Delhi and Madhya Pradesh being the worst affected. The country has recorded 15 million cases so far and more than 184,000 deaths. Health experts say the unprecedented second wave could be blamed on a double mutant variant strains and recent religious gatherings and election campaigns, which has brought the healthcare to a breaking point.
India's coronavirus crisis is deepening further with each passing day, and the country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی
مسافرین گرامی، خواهش من در جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, although in 2015, representatives from six nations signed an agreement dealing with Iran's nuclear program, it almost appears that there are some which want to start all over again with negotiations. Iran says it will not renegotiate the agreement and that the U.S. must rejoin the JCPOA and remove all sanctions immediately and all at once, and this be verified before Tehran remove its remedial measures. Washington says it will not remove all sanctions at once. Well, this is the backdrop to continue talks between the JCPOA signatories, with the U.S. also in attendance in Vienna.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are preparing to hold fresh talks aimed at reviving the accord in the wake of Washington's unilateral pullout in 2018. The parties ended their last and fifth round of such talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, on Tuesday. A U.S. delegation was present in the city, but Iran rejected any discussions with it. Ahead of the upcoming negotiations, Iran's lead negotiator and deputy foreign minister warned that Tehran will not allow the talks to become attritional. Abbas Araghchi also said Iran would stop the negotiations if it detects that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seeks to add new issues to those under discussion. Iran has time and again stressed that the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, can only be salvaged if the country's demands are met.
Iran says the United States must verifiably remove all sanctions that it has imposed, reimposed, and relabeled against the Islamic Republic over the past years. Tehran also stresses that it will not accept the gradual or sequential removal of the sanctions, saying they must be removed all at once. Iran says it will return to compliance with the JCPOA only after it verifies that all sanctions have been removed in practice, not on paper.
Iran's leader has previously said those demands are the country's definitive policy. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has also said the main problem between Iran and the U.S. is that Tehran cannot trust Washington. Iran began to reduce its commitments under the JCPOA a year after former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in May 2018. Earlier this month, Iran also began enriching uranium to 60% purity. All what has been taken is in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to compensate for the U.S. withdrawal. That's what Iran says, stressing that the remedial measures are reversible only after the U.S. fulfills its JCPOA obligations. Iran says its stance on the ongoing talks over the nuclear deal is clear. Now, it seems that it's up to the Biden administration on whether to use the Vienna talks as an opportunity to comply with the JCPOA or continue the maximum pressure campaign launched by its predecessor, a campaign that many White House officials have already described as a failed policy.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate. Out of New York, John Busnich, a political analyst. Out of Tehran, Fuad Izzadi, professor of world studies from the University of Tehran. Nice to have both of you. We're going to start this off in New York with John. Now, it was the U.S. which left the JCPOA, and now Iran is demanding that it returns to the agreement and abide by all of its commitments and remove all sanctions against Tehran first. Do you see this as a reasonable demand on Tehran's part?
Well, obviously, this is the correct starting point for the Iranian position, because it was no fault of Iran's that the sanctions were imposed. And it was an attempt by the U.S. State Department, through the president, to impose additional new conditions and pressures on Iran. So I know that this program is called the debate program, but I couldn't agree with your side more, because there is such a thing as international law. And there are such things as treaties and agreements between states, and those are the most sacrosanct agreements that nations can make. You cannot unilaterally violate them unless you're planning war, and that may have been what they were planning. But now, with any luck, we've avoided these crises, and America has to start playing straight and stop lying, period.
What do you think about that, for Jay? You heard our guest in New York that America now has to start playing straight and stop lying. Because, you know, Iran has demanded that all sanctions be removed from Tehran all at once and then be verified by Iran that the sanctions really have been removed before Tehran reverses remedial actions. Your take on that, and as our other guest said, do you think that America will start playing straight?
Well, if you listen to U.S. Government officials, the answer to that question is no. You can go to the U.S. State Department website. After the delegation, the American delegation returned to Washington a couple of days ago, three, 4 days ago, Rob Malley, who is U.S.'s special envoy on Iran, had a discussion with American reporters. They didn't put his name. They just called him senior State Department official. But based on what we know, it was Rob Malley that was talking. And he was saying that he is not going to, and the United States is not going to lift sanctions. They like some of Trump's sanctions. They like some of Obama's sanctions. They like some of the sanctions that were relabeled by the Trump administration. There's this addiction to sanctions, and whether you're a Republican or a Biden Democrat, you seem to like the sanctions. It's difficult to get rid of that addiction. He was saying that they don't accept this idea of Iran verifying the idea that the sanctions were actually removed. And the third point that was interesting for me, he said that the next U.S. administration may not accept whatever agreement the Biden administration is going to have with Iran. And we have an experience on that with the Trump administration that just left the nuclear agreement. So when you put these three things together, you have no other choice but to give a negative answer to the question that you asked.
Your take, John. You heard.
Well, I agree.
Yeah,
you heard
what Fuad said. I mean, so is it a diplomatic ploy by the United States, as Fuad said? State Department made these statements a few days ago. What is it exactly? Do they want to return? They don't want to return, or what? On the one hand, Iran has said that they must drop all sanctions, they must cancel, remove all sanctions. On that side, the U.S. is saying, well, the State Department spokesman said that it would not do that. And on the other hand, it's saying that perhaps another administration would not be loyal to an agreement. So tell me, your perspective, what is going on here?
I have to understand where your laughter comes from, because it is like the theater of the absurd. It's not like you're dealing with a government. It's like you're dealing with a gang of two-bit criminals who say to you, we'll sign a contract with you, but we can't guarantee that it will be abided by. But when you enter into that contract, you have to do everything on your side, but we'll do nothing on our side. And at the end of all of that, you have to let us come over there and inspect whether you've done everything that you should do on your side while we do nothing on our side. And then at the end of that, you should say you're happy and thankful. It's almost like it's like a parody of political interaction. And I think that Iran's people and the Iranian government know full well who they're dealing with. And I think they have to be on their guard. And I think they have to continue to tighten their relations with other superpowers like China, like Russia, like India, and build together for a multilateral, balanced, non-polarized world. Because so long as we allow one power to dictate illegally to to anybody around the world, this world will never see peace. Never. And I think that Iran is really in a position here to set an example for the whole world, because Iran is completely within its rights. It is completely within international law. And having worked with governments in Japan, in Canada, and in Europe, I can tell you that they all know that Iran is right here. And so you may help to liberate some of these American colonies from their masters.
What do you think about that, Fuad, what John said? They all know that Iran is in the right, and perhaps they will change. Does it make a difference? John was talking about international law. Now, these entities that have been part of this JCPOA, one would think that they would know international law and know that the United States was in violation of international law prior to leaving the JCPOA, and even since that time with more and more illegal sanctions being implemented against Tehran. Does it make a difference? Do you think that it can make a difference with these other countries that Iran has abided by its side of the agreement every step of the way?
Well, the Biden administration is in continuation of violating international law. The United States is a member of the Security Council, a permanent member of the Security Council. Following UN resolutions is international law. And the Trump administration obviously violated international law when Trump left the nuclear agreement. Biden has been in office for about 3 months, and he continues to follow that same policy. We have people sitting in the White House that are not allowing Iran to use its own money to pay for COVID vaccines, resulting in people getting killed. And they talk about human rights, and they sanction Iran for violation of human rights. So the people in the White House are not normal. They engage in these type of illegal activities, and more than just violating international law, they violate basic human rights principles. That when you have a pandemic, sanctioning the country and not allowing it to use its own money to pay for vaccines or pay for other things that countries generally need to have to fight the pandemic is a war crime. So they engage in an economic war, and they engage in criminal activities while they're imposing this economic war on Iran. So that's what you have in the Biden administration.
Well, John, Iran's top negotiator at the Vienna talks, Abbas Araghchi, says Iran will not let the talks take too long or get off track. No other demands outside the original agreement will be discussed. Your take on that? Do you think that that can happen, or he will be able to direct the situation to that?
I think that we've agreed now on the principle that Iran's position is legal and is correct in terms of international law as well. And now we have to start into the what they call realpolitik, which means the reality of politics. And the reality of politics is much dirtier than the law. The United States is effectively not the world's policeman, but the world's bully. And as a bully, it tends to flex its muscles. Now, although Trump was a very, very loud-mouthed president of the United States, one can give him the credit for being the first president since World War II not to start a war. And so Trump probably took direction from the people who support him to put sanctions on. Biden is a totally different creature. Biden is what we would call a warmonger. There's never been a war that Biden didn't support. So I am concerned that Biden, in his what's evidently entering senility, might come under the influence of the State Department, which is actually just the Department of War. And I think that Iran has to play realpolitik. Iran has to count on its allies to ensure its protection. And Iran has to prepare for every kind of pressure that could come from the United States. And that is the full range of activity, including so-called punitive rocket strikes and so on. And I deeply regret to say that that's the way this world works, but I believe that Iran is a strong country, and I believe that the people of Iran have had enough experience with America that they know that the only possible course of action is to stand firm. That's the only way to go. And in that way, Iran will show America that you cannot get away with some kind of illegal activity when you're dealing with Iran. And I do believe that Iran has to stay strong on this. When I was working with the Japanese government, there were several instances when we had to tell America no, N-O, and America backed down. There is a precedent.
Okay, well, what your take on that? Do you think Tehran's role right now is to play realpolitik, as John has said, or the direction you think that Tehran should be taking?
You know, Iran has figured out what the United States is all about. We have had the difficulties with the United States dating back to the 1953 coup. Before we had anything called the Islamic Republic. So this type of hostility towards Iranian people has been around for decades, and people realize that it's not going to go away. It doesn't make a difference whether you have a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. And since we have this history of confrontation by the United States, I think more and more people realize that the only way out is this culture of resistance, because there is no other choice for the Iranian people to be able to defend themselves. And there are ways that Iran can use its own leverages towards the other side. Iran's nuclear development is extensive. No matter how much the Israelis try to sabotage this program, Iran's knowledge on peaceful nuclear development is very deep. And as you have seen, the Iranian government has taken steps in the last few weeks to actually increase activities, Iran's activities in this area. Iran has said that the country is not interested in a nuclear bomb. Iran is a member of NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, and since Iran is a member, using nuclear technology for peaceful purposes is a right that we have. Enriching uranium as a member of NPT is a right that countries have. So exercising that right is going to be leveraged. So the more pressure you get from the United States and countries like Israel, there is no other choice but to push back. And I think that's what the country has decided to do. Iran's parliament, as you know, passed a law that required the executive branch to actually increase Iran's activities in this area. And that's going to apply. They extended, there was an agreement between Iran and International Atomic Energy Agency that's nearing an end. And I don't think the Iranian government will extend that deadline because we don't see much progress in Vienna talks. And, you know, when we read American media, Israeli media, we see the true purpose of the U.S. government coming to these talks. For example,
20 seconds.
Times of Israel, this article that talking to a Biden administration official saying that we want to create a front against Iran by coming to these talks. So there is no decision on the American government to change its policies towards Iran.
And on that note, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us. John Bosnich, political analyst out of New York, and Fuad Ezzadi out of Tehran, professor of world studies, University of Tehran. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Good old days. I really loved my school days. The memory of my classmates, the school, the chalkboard will never fade. Today I'm going to visit an old school, which is very different from the schools of my childhood, to the Aulia school in the historic city of Tun. The historic city of Tun is located in South Khorasan province. The name of this city was changed to Ferdows in 1929. The city has many attractive sites. Among them, mention can be made of Aulia Religious School. This school dates back to late Safavid era. The school was used by religious scholars and students before the 1968 earthquake. The architecture of this magnificent school is really unique and eye-catching. One can describe the school's architecture as unparalleled among other religious schools. The historic Aulia Religious School includes the entrance, the vestibule, the prayer hall, the school, and the chambers. All these structures surround a central yard. Currently, this school is not in special use and is just a site for the enthusiast of Iranian history, architecture, and tourism to visit. I am now standing by the historic Olya Religious School. This school still remains magnificent even after such a long period of time. The entrance includes a high E1 and two corbel arches, which are placed on the two sides. The area of the entrance is very beautiful. I have to go inside quickly to see more beauties. The architecture of Olya School is wonderful. In other cities, there are rarely buildings with such a unique structure. This school is a type of 4E1 school, with the students' chambers on its three sides. The external decorations of this structure is brickwork, though the inner part of the school includes the plasterwork. Just behind the entrance E1, there is a beautiful vestibule. On the eastern side of this vestibule, there is the school, which has an octagonal design and dome-like cover. And here is the prayer hall, which has Mugharnas decorations, which is very beautiful. Mugharnas is a form of ornamented vaulting in Islamic architecture. I am now in the yard of Olya School. There is a beautiful brick pit with an octagonal shape at the center of the yard. One of the characteristics of the architecture of this structure is the repetition of the octagonal shape in different parts. And let me tell you something interesting about the brick pit. In the past, water entered into the pit from one side and went out from another side. And I'd like to sit next to this beautiful brick pit and only watch the beauties of the Olya School. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard
was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.